I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Attorney General Doug Gansler leaves office in January after serving as Maryland's top lawyer since 2007. But he's still busy and making news. He's called for vacating the sentences of Maryland's remaining death row inmates, arguing that the state no longer has the authority to carry out executions because the General Assembly abolished capital punishment last year. And earlier this week, his office released a report on sexual assault policies for the state's universities. Coming up on Midday, from his work on mortgage fraud to his groundbreaking ruling on same-sex marriage to his run for governor, an exit interview with Maryland Attorney General Doug Gansler, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us, making Midday a part of your day. In the second hour of our show today, longtime political analyst Jeff Greenfield will be joining us. That's a treat. Jeff has been on CNN, PBS, ABC. Over the years, done some great stuff, political analysis. He's also written 13 books, and the latest one that he's just updated presents an alternate history. Had President Kennedy survived an assassination 51 years ago tomorrow, as a matter of fact, what would have happened? How history might have been different? How the 1960s might have been different had President Kennedy survived, served a second term? That's the premise of Jeff Greenfield's book, based on lots of plausibility, I might say. It seems like a parlor game that historians indulge in, you know, what-if questions. But this is very good. We'll get a chance to speak with Jeff Greenfield in the second hour of our show. Attorney General Doug Gansler of Maryland has served the state as its top lawyer since January 2007. And this January, he leaves office. We thought we'd spend some time with Attorney General Gansler today, sort of an exit interview, I guess you might call it. Nice to see you, Doug Gansler. Thanks for coming into the show.
It's good to see you. I think they should do a book on what would happen if Dan Rodericks became governor. Maryland change?
Oh, what a scenario that might be. I don't know. So what about, since you brought that up, maybe we ought to cover that first. You know, I haven't talked to you since the primary, really. I haven't spoken to you since last June. So how did you process all that out? You know, losing the primary, and then what did you think of this of the general election? I'm curious.
Well, obviously, no one wants to lose, and I put myself out there because I thought I'd be the best person to be governor. And obviously, had I been in the general election, the Democrats would have won by 20 to 25%. So it's a little disheartening to see what did in fact happen. It's not surprising what happened, but it was disheartening to see what happened. And so now, you know, look, I've been in government service for 22 years. I've been making a government salary for 22 years. So this will be doors open, and I'm looking forward to the next steps.
What did you just say about the outcome of the election 2 weeks ago?
I don't remember. Well, when you're 52 years old, you forget.
I mean,
we would have won.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
You think you would have won had you been the candidate?
I know I would have won if I'd been the candidate.
You think you would have beaten Larry Hogan?
Absolutely. Well, because if you just look what the election was about, it was about two things, I guess. One was it was O'Malley Brown. We had none of that national effect of the Obama feel. I mean, that did not happen in Maryland. I was running. I talked to people all over the state. It was much more about the O'Malley Brown administration and really not even the social issues that I'd been so involved in, marriage equality and Dream Act and that kind of thing. It was much more focused on taxes and jobs. And that was the message I was running on as well, though I was running it with a different audience. Mine was a Democratic primary pool of people who really weren't focused on the election anyway in June at this time, and we had very low turnout. I think the general electorate really understood that we have an issue with our taxes here in Maryland. We have an issue with our businesses and therefore jobs in Maryland. And the election results were not surprising whatsoever.
So you would have focused, your message would have been focused on the economy, creating jobs. What about taxes?
Well, the same thing. I mean, I was talking about taxes all through. I mean, here's the thing. To me, if you tax everybody out of the state, if you tax all the businesses out of the state, you have no jobs, and therefore your tax base keeps decreasing.
Hogan kept saying that. Do you buy that
totally
that's the case?
It. totally buy, because you see it. I mean, look, the facts speak for themselves. We're 49th in the country in terms of economic growth. We're 49th in the country in terms of personal income growth. I mean, we're at the bottom 5 to 10 spots in the country in almost every economic indicator. I mean, look at Baltimore City. 46% of the adult African-American males don't have a job. I mean, you start there and you're looking at four, you know.
So if you were the candidate and you were saying those things and Larry Hogan was saying those things, you think you would have won just because of the numbers of Democrats in the state?
Well, right. And because it's
primarily the same message.
He did adopt my message, but it's not because, you know, I just sort of came at that out of thin air. I believe it. I believe that we have to have jobs back in Maryland. When you have four Fortune 500 companies in this state, there's a serious problem. And I do think it's not because, you know, I don't have a company. I take my put my ATM card in there. It says available balance 0.00. I mean, it's not like it helps me, but I do think that if you don't retain or attract business, jobs aren't coming here, and people leave, and you have to keep taxing people, and it's a never ending cycle. So, I think it's all, you know, the values. I think I share the values of the people in Maryland, but I do think there was a very strong calling for an assessment of where we are economically, and in a subset of that would be taxes.
Just one more political question, if you don't mind. A lot of people were surprised at the Brown campaign going after Larry Hogan with negative advertising almost out of the box in August and September, wondering where the advertising highlighting Anthony Brown was, and finally we saw some of that. But most primarily it was an attack attack model that they used on Larry Hogan. Did that surprise you that he did that, that the Brown campaign did that?
I think I'd be the last person that was surprised since they did it to me as well.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, they made up stories about troopers and crazy stuff.
I forgot who I talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Who I'm talking to here.
Oh, no. But, I mean, I'm reading the stuff in the papers, though. Are you kidding?
That can't be about me.
Yeah.
But also in the primary, there were Brown advertisements, Brown commercials featuring Anthony Brown and his family, his background, his history, his bio.
You know, negative ads are a very unfortunate reality in politics. People say I don't like them, but they clearly work. The problem, there's a lot of problems with what happened in this campaign. The Monday morning quarterbacks will go over them at some length. But one, to your question, you do want to define yourself before the other person defines you. Now, he forgot that. Their campaign forgot that part about defining the lieutenant governor before they then defined Hogan. So what they did instead was try to define him. And no, it was so over the top and so unbelievable that, you know, that no one really believed that Larry Hogan was going to take AK-47s and start shooting up kids or shooting up supermarkets. And that's what the ads were showing. I remember sitting there in August, you know, watching television, seeing all these Hogan negative ads come on and thinking, well, they're doing millions and millions of dollars of favors to Hogan, putting his name recognition out there. Nobody heard of Larry Hogan. This guy has a couple people. He's a real estate developer, never held office,
right. You
know, never had any involvement. He's a very decent fellow, and I hope he does well. But nobody had heard of him. People thought it was David Craig was going to be the nominee.
Right.
And so here is millions of dollars. Oh, that's the guy who's going to be running against the O'Malley Brown taxes and mm-hmm. job problem.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what he's all about. And then by, you know, November, they forgot what those ads were about, but they certainly remember the name.
Yeah. 410-662-8780. I put the number out because Doug Gansler is here for the hour, Maryland's Attorney General. He came into office January 2007, goes out of office in January 2015. Brian Frosch, former state senator Brian Frosch, will become the Attorney General to succeed him. I wanted to talk about some recent news here. First, the story a couple weeks ago, your announcement about death row inmates and your advice to the state on this.
Yeah, so what happened was that, you know, the General Assembly repealed the death penalty, but specifically left out the five people that were on death row at the time. Now, one of them has died since then, so there's four left. And they did so for, I think, the right reasons, because had they made it retroactive, there might have been constitutional implications on the statute itself. So they said, we're going to carve out the people that are already on death row, we're going to make this prospective, but we're going to remind the governor that he or she has the right to commute those sentences to life without the possibility of parole. And the listeners should understand that life without the possibility of parole is a death sentence. You are living in a cage and coming out in a box in the end. Life sentence is not. Life, you're parole eligible in 25 years. So that was how it was left. Now, one of the death row inmates filed an appeal, and we do all the criminal appeals in the Office of the Attorney General. And I could have argued that we should continue down the road toward executing this particular man, Mr. Miles. However, I did not feel that it was morally the right thing to do because legally and factually, it's impossible for that execution to be carried out. I mean, at one level, the optics of actually executing somebody in a state that doesn't have the death penalty would be unseemly at least. But as a legal matter, what happened was, and this is a little more law, but when they repealed the death penalty, with it came the enabling statute for the Division of Corrections to promulgate regulations for lethal injection. So remember, O'Malley did this moratorium, and there was never any of these regulations that were actually promulgated. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was when they took out the death penalty, they took out the enabling statute. So today, as we sit here, there's no mechanism by which the Division of Corrections can promulgate protocols to execute somebody with lethal injection. So they're not going to be executed. And under due process, there's a case called Jackson in the Supreme Court. That, to me, that's wrong to hold them there, knowing full well they're not going to get the death penalty, put them on death row and have the expense involved with that and all the uncertainty when it's actually certain. So that was what we did. And hopefully their sentences will be commuted so that we don't have to go through the legal jump rope in the hurdles of the legal things down the road for these other people.
You could have also anticipated that attorneys for those inmates would argue in a state that's abolished the death penalty, you can't execute these individuals.
They did argue that, but they were wrong on that. In other words, their argument there is that the sentences...
You say they would not have prevailed with that argument.
They would not have prevailed with that argument on under the law because there was nothing illegal about the sentences at the time that they were meted out. And so they could still be executed. It's like they changed penalties all the time in crimes. But there is a due process argument.
When you refer to optics, you're not referring to legalities, but indeed how this would look to the public.
It
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of reaction did you get to that? Most people in the state accept that the death penalty's gone, see this as common sense, or did you? I'm sure you heard from the families of,
right, the families
of victims because they were prominent in the press reporting on it.
Yeah, I think the families of the victims understandably were upset because, you know, their loved one is good. Look, most people the reality is I've been a prosecutor for 22 years. The reality is almost everybody, with exceptions, I had a case with a Monsignor's family felt it differently, but almost everybody who is against the death penalty is for the death penalty when somebody in their family is murdered, raped, tortured, and all that. So understandably, the families are, in this particular case, were upset. They watched their loved one got murdered. They watched the trial. They watched the jury give out the sentence that they wanted, and now it's being pulled out from them. But that's not anybody's fault except for the General Assembly passing the law to repeal the death penalty. Whether you're for the death penalty or against the death penalty, to me, it's irrelevant in this conversation. It's all about what the law is and what the law provides.
Attorney General Doug Gansler is our guest for the hour. We'll take our first break here and come back and take some calls if you have questions for Doug Gansler. Remember our number, 410-662-8780. We have an email address. We can read emails on the air. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. You can also tweet a question to MiddayWYPR. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's with Attorney General Doug Gansler of Maryland in our studio to answer questions about his two terms as Attorney General, 410-662-8780. Other news related this week, I just wanted to ask you about Attorney General Gansler advising the state university system on sexual misconduct on college campuses.
Yeah, that's an issue that's obviously gotten a lot more attention in the last couple of years than it had in the previous century.
Yeah.
And it's an issue that's been going on for a very, very long time, the idea of sexual assaults on college campuses. Not as much stranger on stranger, the kind of you're walking home and somebody pulls you into an alley and things and you get raped and that kind of thing. That can happen really anywhere. It's more focused on, you know, date rape and sexual assaults that happen amongst people who know each other. And, you know, what we did was, you know, we represent the universities of Maryland. And so what we did was we issued a report after months of looking into this. And I got very involved in my role as in the National Association of Attorneys General. We've done a lot around this. And so what we've asked all the schools to do is come in with policies and procedures by the end of the year. And then we're going to try and look at best practices on how to resolve these issues. These aren't easy issues. I mean, 89% of these cases involve alcohol. Very often the aggressor and the victim themselves don't know exactly what happened and how, but we need to make sure that there's a number of things going on. One is sort of what happens when these sexual assaults do occur. Do you know even who you would report to? What's the relationship between campus police, local police, state police? What, you know, there's a lot of, and how are these cases investigated? And then there's the bigger idea, which is my view of how to prevent them in the first place. And that is really looking at bystander intervention. You know, right now, if somebody leaves a party and they're drunk, you know, most kids will say, look, hey, are you okay? Can you really drive? Let me take the keys. I'll make sure you get home, that kind of thing. It becomes your friend's problem. Sexual assaults, you know, you see somebody on the couch that's drunk, clearly not in a condition to be able to consent to any sexual activity. Instead of saying that's not my problem, or the school's ultimately saying that's not our problem, it is your problem. And you need to say, hey, look, are you okay? Just create a distraction, get the person out, make sure they can get home. So that's what the report is that we put out there. Not an easy issue.
That would include some training for students? Then?
Training for students, you know, not just the day you show up, but making sure there's ongoing training. There's a lot of, around the country, there's things called green dot programs where there's a lot of more around the idea of education and intervention by bystanders.
410-662-8780 is our number here for Doug Gansel. I've got a bunch of questions more for the Attorney General, but we'll take some from our listeners now. Karen in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I'm an independent. I happen to register as a Democrat, and I did vote for Mr. Gansler in the primary, and I would have voted for him in the election. And I ended up voting for Mr. Hogan, and I think a lot of it was the job and tax thing. I think part of it is I didn't feel a strong sense of engagement with Mr. Brown. And I'll be honest with you, a little bit of, for me, was like a bit of a payback, because I voted for Governor Ehrlich, what was that, three elections ago? Mm-hmm. And I never understood why he couldn't get elected again. He seemed like a decent guy who did a good job. So I kind of felt like, well, okay, we had you know, Democratic governors for two terms. It's kind of time to moderate back towards the right to kind of, you know, balance things out. And I'm not displeased with the results of the election. I just know this is kind of the way it went with me. And I'm hoping that someday Mr. Gansler will return to public service, because I think he's wonderful.
Thank you very much, Karen. So, and I'm sure other people have said to you, well, Doug, you know, don't give up forever, and you like politics. What do you say when people say that to you?
Well, I can't tell you how many people. Thank you, Karen, by the way, for your sentiment. My mom would appreciate that you would have voted for me. but I do get, you know, I in the last couple of weeks, I can't count how many people have said, well, obviously you would have won, we made a mistake, and that kind of thing. But also, you know, please stay involved, run again, do whatever. You know, and it's in my blood. I mean, I've been doing this the last 22 years, so, you know, There's certainly a possibility I will do that down the road. We'll see how it goes. You know, people are starting to talk about the next election in 4 years, and Governor-elect Hogan hasn't even been sworn in yet. So, you know, we want to give him a chance, and let's see how he does. To answer just the, you know, I do study politics. I love politics. I mean, the answer on Governor Ehrlich was interesting. When he left office, he had a 57% favorable rating. What we forget was that was the year that, like this year, that was the second term of George W. Bush midterm election. Huge Democratic year. Yeah, and this was a big Republican year. So that, I think that played a little bit of a part in it. But let me just use your sentiment to actually say something I think we should do in Maryland, which is I think we should open up the primary process to independents. I'm not suggesting we have a fully open primary where Republicans vote for Democrats and that kind of thing, but you should not have to compromise. You as an independent should not have to be disenfranchised, in my view, in the primaries. I think you should be able to pick either the Republican or the Democratic primary and be able to vote in those primaries. I'd like to see that in the future.
I want to bring up a topic that I know that you care about. I've written about it from time to time. Every once in a while, I pull this topic out, I write a column about it in The Sun, and then it's gone. People don't seem to latch on to it and do something about it, and that is the election of judges. You know, I got an email this year from somebody who said, Dan, help me out here. I'm a Baltimore City voter, and I got my sample ballot in the mail, and I don't know any of these judges, and what would I base a vote for a judge on anyway? So I wrote a column about that recently, and I know that you actually were pushing to do away with judicial elections.
I've been pushing this for many years, and I applaud you for bringing it to the public, because people don't even know about it until election time, and then they forget it. And to your point just there, what would you base your vote on? And there's three major problems I have with the idea of electing judges. One, it actually comes out of a case in West Virginia called Caperton, a Supreme Court case, where they said it was improper because if you think about it, nobody knows who the judges are except the defense lawyers that appear before them. So you have this really unseemly idea of judges picking up the phone and calling lawyers that appear before them. So you're there
for campaign donation.
For a campaign donation. And yeah. So you're the poor schmuck being charged with something, and the lawyer on the other side is that gave that judge a lot of money. You're like, well, how's that fair? So that's problem number one. Problem number two is politics. I mean, you want the best and the brightest people to be judges. You don't want the person that happens to be able to knock on the most doors or stand on the side of the road waving signs at random cars. And you don't want judges to be able to, I mean, look, no judge that's running for office is going to go to a civic meeting and say, elect me, I will let every drug dealer out. They're going to say the opposite. And you really don't want judges, in my view, making decisions based on whim or politics. You want them to look at the facts of that case and make a decision in accordance with the law, and whether you like it or not, that's the way it should be. But the biggest reason why I really approach it is diversity. So as we sit here talking right now, there's never been in the history of Maryland, in a contested election, an African-American elected to any bench, to be a judge, anywhere in Western Maryland, anywhere in Southern Maryland, or anywhere on the Eastern Shore. And to me, that's crazy. And, you know, in Baltimore and Prince George's County, the two majority-minority districts, there's a lot of diversity on the bench. And you know, you can't really quantify it, but there's not a diversity problem on the bench. But there certainly is elsewhere in the state. And there are numerous examples of people who have run and lost because, to your point, nobody knows who it is. So what they do is they'll put a picture of the African-American. This is the judge. They put a picture of the white guy. I want to be the judge. And who wins every single time? The white candidate.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, your point about attracting the best and brightest to the bench in the state, because we want that. I mean, it used to be a noble calling, you know, for attorneys to consider a judgeship. The problem is the Constitution says that even if you're appointed, you have to run in an election, the next election out, right? 2 years after you're appointed, you could lose an election. So you give up your practice or whatever you're right. doing, and you figure you're going to be a judge first, maybe on the district court, then circuit court. You get on the circuit court, and then you face election, and maybe you lose.
So well, it's actually the worst of all systems that we have, because if you think about it, you're on that next ballot within those 2 years. So to the extent anybody actually does want to look at your record and look at cases and facts and how you made those
only have a
you have no record under your belt
period,
for that.
Right.
And so what I want to do is convert the judicial election, the trial court level, to match what we do for the Court of Special Appeals and the Court of Appeals, which is simply a retention ballot. So, yes, you're appointed by the governor, and then you're put up yay or nay. So we had a case this year in Montgomery County.
After how long? Right
after right away.
The next election?
Yeah, and then you're up again. Then you're up in 10 years.
10 years, right.
See, not right now it's 15 for the trial judge. So actually mm-hmm. 10 years later, then you have an opportunity. There's a judge in Montgomery County that a lot of people had some problems with, and there's some issues.
Yeah, right about it.
Right. And so she, if she had been on a retention ballot, it would have been yay or nay on her, and there could have been a contest there. Instead, she gets swept in with the incumbent ballot,
mm-hmm.
and now they have to
judges.
Deal with the sitting judges, that
right.
they call it. Yes.
They always tell you, vote for the sitting judges.
So I think we're in dire need of reformation on how we elect our judges.
Okay, but you have to go to the Constitution and fix that.
Well, you go to the right? General Assembly that can then do it, yes.
Okay. Doug Gansler is our guest, Maryland's Attorney General, 410-662-8780 is our number. Question from John for the AG. John, go right ahead. John, are you there? Okay, he's not there. Here's my question for you. I'm wondering, you know, you look over the last 8 years, some of the high points for you. I'm picking for you February 24th, 2010, declaring that Maryland will recognize same-sex marriages performed elsewhere and that its agencies, the state agencies, should immediately begin affording gay married couples the same rights as heterosexual ones. This was a big story at the time. At the time, the state of Maryland had not moved to advance marriage equality, and that was a pretty important decision that you rendered, opinion that you rendered. You know, some people think it turned the tide in the state for same-sex marriage.
You know, when I first got elected, there's an opportunity as a lawyer to make money at a law firm. I chose not to. I chose to go into public service, and I've been was a federal prosecutor for 6 years, a state attorney for 8 years, and this attorney general for 8 years. And I figured, why have this job if you're not going to do the right thing for the right reasons? And so what I did one day was I got up, I drove to Annapolis and testified on behalf of same-sex marriage years before this opinion, the 2007-2008 timeframe, because I thought it was the right thing to do. I was so naive, I don't even understand the arguments against it. These are people who are being discriminated against because of the way they were born and their sexual orientation. And so the people said, well, don't do that. You're going to, you know, it's going to kill you politically. Well, ultimately, actually, when I wrote that opinion, they literally tried to impeach me.
I remember.
And it was like, you got to be kidding me. And it was a horrible thing and all this. So that same year, I stand for election in 2010. I was the only statewide candidate in America, non-federal, to have no primary or general election opponent. You know, no one really cares. I mean, I always say it's the most Republican of issues. Two people contracted to do whatever they want, leave the government out of their private lives. So, you know, to me, when the ability to render that opinion came in, I thought, look, that's the right thing to do. And so
let's go over again what that did. The state would recognize same-sex marriages
of the
from
six
other states.
Yeah.
Right?
So at that time, there were six states that recognized marriage and marriage equality. Some of them are odd. Iowa being one. You wouldn't have thought that.
I remember.
Was, you know, Massachusetts, that kind of thing. So the question was whether that contract that was valid in Iowa or Massachusetts would be recognized is valid here. So it really, as a matter of law, was much more on the full faith and credit constitutional provision than, you know, on due process or equal protection. But that, of course, plays into it. But I thought it was the right thing to do. The jurisprudence in my mind supported it. And it really, I think it helped, you know, kick the can down the road toward what we have now, which is
marriage equality. And pretty quickly. I mean, this was 2010.
Right.
We had a vote on this in 2012. Right.
Yeah, and you know, there's national sentiment in favor of it. People now recognize, and there's a lot of reasons why that is. In my view, most of it is because it's not like, you know, there was nobody that was gay in my high school class. Really? Of course there were, but nobody would talk about it.
Right.
And so the fact is, we're in a time now where people have their neighbors, people have family members, people have people they work with that are out and, you know, they're openly gay, and they're just like everybody else with the same desires and same needs. And people realize that, you know, they should not be deprived of their due process and really the pursuit of happiness.
Thomas, is Thomas there? We'll take his call for Doug Gansler. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yeah, I wanted to ask, you've referred to yourself repeatedly as the environmental attorney general, but now I hear that after your term is ended, you're going to work for a company, the firm that's represented, BP. I'm just wondering why.
Represented who?
BP, is that right, Tom? Did you say BP?
Yes, sir. Yes, BP.
Well, I first of all, I didn't know that they represented BP.
You're going to Buckley Sandler
yeah.
LLP. Right?
Yeah, so I'm going to a law firm. You know, obviously I wanted to be governor. That didn't the voters. What's that old quote? The voters have spoken. Those
spoken.
Bastards.
Yeah.
So I don't get to be governor, so I have to, you know, make a living. And so I'm going to go to a law firm. And I was very fortunate. I had a lot of opportunities and wanted to, you know, sort of pick and choose what firms that would make sense for me. Buckley Sandler made sense to me because it's a very young firm. They do a lot of interesting work. Their most sort of high profile case was representing the Navajo Indians against the United States government, against the Department of Justice for wrongdoings. And they were able to get a $550 million settlement. So they did very well on that case. You know, in terms of BP, you know, I actually led the attorneys general on going after them, making sure they preserved evidence and so forth. When they had the big oil spill, you know, we went after ExxonMobil and we've done it here in Maryland, had the biggest environmental case here in Maryland regarding that. You know, I will, when I go to the firm, I will sort of pick and choose who I personally will, which cases I'll work on. And obviously there'll be some moral decisions involved with that.
Like, I'm not going to. What wouldn't you touch?
Well, I wouldn't touch sex offenders
Really? I mean, you go into financial services?
I appreciate, I think it's wonderful that there are lawyers that will represent anybody who's accused of doing anything. I have sort of, like, I don't want to do tobacco, for example. I just, as an attorney general, we've spent so much time on tobacco
cases.
We'll
mark that one off the list.
Yeah.
And you said sex offenders.
Yeah, and that kind of thing.
But what about, given the work you did, for instance, in the big financial settlement with the, is it Ocwen, by the way? OC?
Ocwen was another. Ocwen. That was sort of the subsequent
mortgage,
to the bigger one.
Mortgage fraud and, you know, foreclosure abuse. Would you represent companies that were back to their old, those practices again? Because, frankly, a lot of people.
Well, the hope
wonder
is they
how
can't
much
be.
Is, well,
you know, and
we
that's,
really wonder how
right,
much is going to change
right,
or has changed.
So I was president of the National Association of Attorneys General during the time when the the big case, the National Mortgage Foreclosure Settlement, was being levied against the five major banks, right. J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and so forth. And, you know, we at this moment, we've got over $1.5 billion into Maryland to help keep tens of thousands of people in their homes that otherwise would have been foreclosed upon. But part of that settlement, there was 42 pages of procedures in terms of how in the future going forward, that these types of things can't happen again. Now, in terms of
Do you believe that? What's your assessment of what Congress has done in the wake of that?
I believe that they would be very difficult to do the same thing. Do I think the banks will engage in insidious conduct and take advantage of people? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so
high-risk loans?
Yeah. And so what I need to do is when I go to this firm and I represent a bank or whatever, I'm more representing people and companies to make sure they're complying with the law. And that would be my role, that what I'm doing there.
Say the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, according to the Sun story, that's all I have here, is that the firm you're going to does a lot of work there.
Right. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau came out of the Dodd-Frank Act. In fact, the head of that is Richard Cordray, who was the Attorney General of Ohio and was actually my mentee when he came to the National Association. He's a wonderful guy, and they do great work. So they will have companies that they look at and investigate and issue subpoenas to, and I will hopefully be able to represent some of those companies and work out a compromise and make sure that they are complying with law and regulation and what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau wants them to do.
Glenwood. Is it Glenwood, Maryland, Devin? I'm sorry.
This is Glenwood.
Glenwood. All right. Thank you. Go right ahead. You're on with Doug Gansler.
Mr. Gansler, I want to thank you on behalf of all of Maryland for the excellent, excellent work that you did for all our citizens as Attorney General. But I have a question for you regarding your record. As stellar as your record was or is, why is it that during the campaign you did not emphasize it more? Altieri Homes is a case in point.
Altieri Homes.
Just to refresh his memory, was the largest. Do you recall?
Yeah, that was in Prince George's County.
He actually was in Howard for a while and then in Carroll, but he became the largest builder of estate homes in Maryland. But he was unscrupulous.
And we went after him.
The Consumer Protection.
What happened was that Mr. Gansler brought suit against him because he would start building homes and not complete them, leave potential homeowners in the.
I remember the case. I do remember the case, and thank you. No, I appreciate that. I mean, in terms of making my record known, I mean, look, we tried. I had the entire Democratic establishment lined up against me. They wanted to coronate the successor to Governor O'Malley. And, you know, we tried to get our message out there, but it was pretty there's a lot of white noise behind it, you know, in terms of the establishment, the newspapers. I mean, the newspapers would endorse them over me, and they would say, you know, Gansler's been a great attorney general. The lieutenant governor has this problem and that problem. We endorse the lieutenant governor. And so it was very difficult to sort of overcome that and get the message out, particularly in a primary that usually it's in September. This year was in June. People weren't focused. The turnout was, you know, historically low. And so really what happened was the establishment, the Democratic establishment, just pushed their candidate out in the primary, notwithstanding the fact that it was extremely unlikely that that person was going to win in a general election. And, you know, the other time we've done this was, you know, years ago with the lieutenant governor as well. And that's the two times that the Democratic establishment has anointed a candidate and said, look, we're going to dispense with democracy this time. We're just going to tell you who it is we're going to pick and you're going to vote for them. Both of those candidates lost in the general election.
I just want to say one thing about consumer protection and your office in general, my perception of it, because I've been around for a while. And my perception is that the office has never been as busy as it's been since you were attorney general. Now, it's not just because you put press releases out, because some press releases come out and there's not much there and you sort of don't pay much attention to it. It's not very newsy. But your office seems to break some kind of news almost daily with some kind of settlement or an announcement of a case that you're bringing, especially the Consumer Protection Division. So I was very impressed in that. The public doesn't get to see all of it because there isn't enough room in the newspaper to report all these things, or they certainly don't get on TV very much unless it's a bigger case and you have a press conference and all that.
Right.
But from day to day, the cumulative effect of all of it is impressive. It's You have a very busy office. You must have a great staff. I don't know. How big is your staff, by
the way? We have 467 lawyers.
Is it that big? I didn't realize it was that big.
And
how busy has that Consumer Protection Division been?
Extremely busy. And it's, look, whether you're Democrat, Republican, or what have you, the Consumer Protection Division is the bread and butter of every office. Attorney General's Office of the country, what I've done is really sort of ratcheted up in terms of making sure that we go after unscrupulous behavior. And yes, we've definitely ratcheted up our, particularly on the environmental side, going after environmental polluters on the criminally and civilly. But, we've, over the last 8 years, we've brought over $2 billion in restitution back to the citizens of Maryland through the Consumer Protection Division. And so, we go after companies, we go after them hard. We protect the good ones. The people that play by the rules, but the ones that don't, we make sure we go after. And, somebody asked me once when I first got to the office, what's the most surprising thing about Attorney General? And the answer for me was the quality of the people who work there. And, these are people who can make a lot more money doing other things.
And they stay a while.
And they stay a while. And, people are always concerned, the new
long
guy's
time.
Coming in.
Yeah.
The new guy's coming. They're going to fire everybody. No. The reality is, as much as, we feel self-important about our job, nobody really cares who's sitting in that chair. They're there to be public servants, to help people. And so, and what's a little bit different since you brought up about the Consumer Protection Division in our office is it's really staffed in large part by volunteers. We have a lot of seniors that come in. And two or three days a week.
Answer
the phone. They mediate cases between the home builder and the person that feels they've been ripped off, or the car dealership and the person that feels. And they find a compromise. They find a middle ground.
Aware of that. You have volunteers. Are they retired attorneys or
they're retired.
Retired anything.
They tend to be seniors almost exclusively. And they're people that have 15, 20, 30, 40 years careers, and they want to continue to give back, and they come down. It's a national model. And we've had people like Secretary Sebelius came in and really highlighted the model of it. And it's a wonderful thing we have because really they gut our money out of our office every year, so we need to have the volunteers.
Sounds like a story to me. All right, we'll take a break here. 410-662-8780. This is Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks in the studio with Doug Gansler, Maryland's Attorney General. You can call in and ask any question you like in the time remaining in this hour. Short break. We'll be right back. Dan Rodericks here with Attorney General Doug Gansler. I did mention Ocwen, OCWEN. That was a small piece of the mortgage fraud settlements, right?
So the national mortgage foreclosure settlement involved five banks: Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citi, GMAC Alley,
right. Wachovia
is Wells Fargo, became Wells Fargo. So the five national banks, but then there were two subsequent: SunTrust and Ocwen were two that we went after because really. The five major ones that we dealt with was about 90% of the non-Fannie and Freddie loans that were out there. And so that really encompassed most of the people who had been taken advantage of. And that was where we got the $1.5 billion in. But then we still had to go after the 14 other banks that were also involved, smaller, but not Fannie and Freddie. And Ocwen was one of them.
Do you think Maryland was disproportionately affected by the mortgage crisis, the collapse of the housing market, and why do you think Maryland was?
Well, we absolutely were. We were the sixth most affected state, which is why we ended up getting the sixth most money. But we actually ended up getting disproportionately more than our share because we did so much public relations. I mean, I was at churches, usually African-American churches, community centers. We did a lot of outreach to make sure that people who were eligible to get this money, in fact, got it.
Why do you think the state ended up sixth on that list?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things, a combination. This was really predatory lending targeted at minorities, and we have a disproportionately high. We have the highest African-American population outside the Deep South in the country. And I think Prince George's County accounted for one-third of our problems in mortgage foreclosures here. And there's a lot of wealthier people, minorities, but wealthier minorities in Prince George's County. So that was more of a prime target for some of these banks.
And the settlements kept people in their homes?
It kept their homes through principal reduction or loan modification. There was also checks that were levied. I mean, just yesterday we had an event down in Prince George's County talking about $10 million. They're actually starting a program for $100 million, but $10 million of which came from our settlement toward neighborhood stabilization in Prince George's County, allowing new home buyers to come into 14 of the worst zip codes that were affected down there. So there's still a lot of money coming in. I mean, look, we're still getting over $100 million a year into Maryland from the tobacco settlement that the attorneys general reached in 1998. So there's going to be some more ramifications in the years to come.
410-662-8780 is our number here. John called back. John had a question for you. John, thanks for calling. You're on Midday.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I had a question about the budget. It seems that Maryland voters gave Hogan a pretty strong mandate to cut taxes, but I've also read where O'Malley has sort of left our state in a pretty horrible budget situation. Do you think that Governor Hogan should cut taxes, even if he has to cut spending on programs like education or the environment to do so?
Well, those are different things, cutting programs and cutting taxes. I mean, I think obviously, the budget is a moral document. And so there's going to be decisions, priority decisions, and moral decisions in terms of what to cut and what not to cut that Governor-elect Hogan's going to have to make, and he's going to have to go over it with his people. And yes, the economic situation in Maryland is very, very dire. And not because necessarily things are bad going in the country. I mean, we're dire compared to our neighbors. And most of our jobs are fleeing and going to Virginia or Delaware or Pennsylvania. And a lot of that is because of the taxes. So what Governor-elect Hogan's going to have to do is balance, you know, the tax burden with cuts. So he's pledged, I think, to the point that, yes, there's certainly a mandate for lower taxes and more fair taxes here in Maryland. So he's going to have to make those assessments, but also make sure that he's not cutting things, programs that we need to have. And it's going to be very difficult. It's going to take some time. And hopefully the Democrats in the General Assembly are willing to work with him to get that done. People need to give him a chance. People need to come together and remember why they got elected to office in the first place, and that's to help the people of Maryland. And it's going to be a combination of the tax cuts and making our tax burden far more competitive, and as at the same time, making sure we're not cutting essential programs.
When you look at the O'Malley administration these last 8 years, because Governor O'Malley, of course, leaving office as well as you are in January, when you consider the recession that this state and the whole country, the whole world went through, what would you say generally about O'Malley's stewardship in terms of the budget, the fiscal condition of the state of Maryland, given those conditions over the last 8 years?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress on social issues that we needed to make progress on, and I think that Governor O'Malley's done a very good job working with the legislature in getting a lot of things passed. I think the economic situation has not been as good. We're not really taking advantage. And I'm really talking about Governor O'Malley. He's, you know, part of it. He's one of many people in elected office. But, you know, our situation economically in Maryland has really been ignored. And so, you know, we're not focused on our industry strengths, such as cybersecurity, biotech, things that we have natural advantages. We're the only state in the country.
You mean we don't promote them enough?
We don't promote them enough.
What don't we do?
Well, we have NIH. You know, we have Johns Hopkins, NSA. The number one hospital. We have NSA. And we have these assets that no other state has, yet we don't leverage it. So one of the things that people talk about, well, we're the number one state for entrepreneurship. That's true, because things are invented here and created here. Yet we're 44th in tech transfer, which means they're created here and then they're produced commercially in some other state. We need to provide economic incentive so that the ideas that are produced, that are created here, imagined here, become products here. So, you know, we need to do like New York did with manufacturing, you know, give tax breaks to companies that are willing to come here. You know, you say to, you know, Kevin Plank or a CEO of one of these companies, you tell us what it'll take for you to put your plant here in Maryland. If it's, you know, free, tax-free for 5-10 years, fine. You know, if you're going to employ 300 people to,
you know, we've done
sneakers.
Some of those things before. I mean, Black & Decker comes to mind, for instance, and
they left.
An investment that was made in their plant in Easton, over on the Eastern Shore, and you know that place is empty now. So, I don't know. Some people are very leery of doing that.
Well, they are, and you know, if you look in Western Maryland, where it used to be, you know, Cumberland, and these cities were just vibrant cities, mm-hmm. They're just empty, and they're dying on the vine, and so you have the footprint of manufacturing. They have the Volvo Mac plant out there, but that's it. And you have the footprints of factories and plants. You can imagine attracting companies to them. We're no longer really competing internationally like we used to be. It's much more level playing field. We're competing with neighboring states.
So had you been elected, if you were governor, you would have put some effort into bringing manufacturing back on that scale.
Manufacturing,
yeah.
I really think with Hopkins and the 270 corridor, you know, we have the skeleton there with Digene, Human Genome Sciences, MedImmune, and then going up to Hopkins, you could really create there's no reason why Palo Alto or Cambridge are cleaning our clocks. We could attract businesses back here, but it's not just one panacea. I think you just have to make it a more positive business environment. And the reason why you need to make it a more positive business environment is to bring jobs here. You have jobs and people are working. You increase your tax base, and you don't have to have the discussion with John in Bethesda about what you're going to cut because you have the money coming in.
On the environmental front, we spent a lot of time on this show talking about the Chesapeake Bay, pollution going into the bay, the role that farming plays in that. And I know as a candidate for governor, you learned a lot about how farming works in the state of Maryland. And as an attorney general, you had to enforce the environmental laws. So as you go out of office, I wonder, what's your general view of that? Where are we on that? Because you hear from farmers, well, we've made a good effort on phosphorus, for instance, but you keep beating us up on this, and it's us against them when it comes to farming in the state. And others say, well, farming is still our main source of pollution. Chicken waste, for instance, a big problem. We still need to crack down and do something about that.
So the environment, it was my top priority when I was Attorney General, and the Chesapeake Bay is, you know, sort of the symbol of that. It's really our signature natural resource here in Maryland. And, you know, I did 24 river audits during my 8 years. You know, every 3 or 4 months went to a different river, spent the day there talking to people, looking at the issues that they have that are, you know, unique to that particular river, but, you know, ubiquitous throughout the state. And there's a lot of things that need to be done. And there is no single solution to what we need to do about the bay. The state of the bay, in my view, is far worse than any of the rhetoric you see. And so you'll see these articles, well, things are improving because it's better than it was last month. I mean, I think we ought to be looking to get back to – we're not going to be able to get back to, you know, John Smith where you put a frying pan over the bay and the fish jump in.
Right.
But we can get back to where we were 50 years ago. And you mentioned poultry and the farming, that piece of it. I do think the farmers are doing a good job of trying to engage in best practices. I think they, like everybody, can do more. The poultry one, though, the poultry issue is very simple. And, you know, I've always been the big symbol that I'm the bad guy for the poultry industry because I attended some conference when I first got elected that Bobby Kennedy was at later in the day.
Right, the Riverkeepers.
Yeah, so therefore, somehow I was, by osmosis, I was the bad guy. But the fact of the matter is I'm actually their biggest supporter because I think what we need to do, we have about 1.5 billion pounds of chicken manure that's produced in Maryland each year, and depending on who you talk to, some a lot or little goes in the bay. We have the capacity now. We live in a time where you could take 500 million pounds of chicken manure and convert it into 55 megawatts of power. That's what we should
use
do.
Use it as an energy source.
Use it as an energy source, a voluntary energy source. I mean, look, you know, I was an economics major at Yale. I didn't do great, but I did well enough that people are going to operate on their self-interest. And what they will do is they'll take the manure they actually need to fertilize their land, and they'll sell the rest. Because they'll make money from it. They'll now have a saleable product, that is chicken manure, mm-hmm. and that we can convert into energy. And that would great. That's our biggest organic source of pollution.
Is anybody working on this?
Well, I've been talking about it for 8 years, and we did have an RFP. There was an RFP last year for 10 megawatts. So they're starting to get with the program here a little bit.
RFP that the state put out?
That the state put out, but very on small scale. And we need to do small scale as well. Anaerobic digestion on individual farms, but we can do the bigger scale as well to get, you know, tons and tons and tons of this from even possibly going in the water and being an energy source.
Right. I don't want to end the show
on
chicken manure, yeah. But it's an important and serious problem.
It is, and it's an industry we want to keep here. You want to keep chicken. You want to have poultry farms in Maryland. If they leave, then you get tract homes, so you want to do it.
We got 1 minute left. Yeah. What would you say is your number one accomplishment as AG? Which one would you point to? Something we mentioned already today?
Yeah, I mean, just because, you know, I have a short-term memory, I would say the mortgage foreclosure settlement would probably be the biggest thing. Yeah, you know, you really see the ramifications of it and the thousands of people that were not removed. I think that the second one would be when I was president of the National Association running starting the conversation on digital privacy, on people's privacy over the internet, privacy policies, and what can companies do with your information and what shouldn't they do. I think that we really sort of push that dialogue nationally.
Well, Doug Gansler, our time is up. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
It was nice to get to have this exit interview with you. Thank you very much for your service to the state of Maryland, too, as Attorney General, Doug Gansler.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the first hour of Midday. We'll take a break now. It's Friday, so Joe Squared has delivered pizza. Once again, Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at JoeSquared.com. They deliver pizza here every Friday for our guests and our staff at WYPR. We have a break coming up, and then the second hour of Midday. I do hope you'll stay tuned.